Sure, the infinite inning is a state of mind, but it also applies to those situations in which vast, implacable, and impersonal forces, with which you by definition cannot contend, are actually arrayed against you. Joe McCarthy, the manager of the Cubs, Yankees, and Red Sox, not the Wisconsin senator who was both a product and an exploiter of the late 1940s Red Scare, is probably still on a statistical basis the greatest manager of all time. 67 years after he retired to his farm in upstate New York, he's still number one all-time with a .615 winning percentage. His entire career was conducted on a 154-game basis, but given 162 games and that winning percentage, it means that his average team, not his good teams, but just his average everyday run-of-the-mill team, would have gone 162 every year. That's how good he was. Now, he also did have the horses everywhere he went. His World Series team in Chicago in 1929 had Rogers Hornsby and Hack Wilson and Kai Kyler. His Yankees teams had Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, Joe DiMaggio, Tommy Henrik, Charlie Keller, Phil Rizzuto, Joe Gordon, you know the drill. And of course, with the Red Sox, he had Ted Williams and Bobby Doerr and Dom DiMaggio and all those other greats. Given that, towards the end of his career, he famously messed up some big games, the 1948 playoff game, Red Sox versus Indians, the snarled 1949 pennant race between the Red Sox and the Yankees. It's tempting to say that his main talent was just for walking into great situations, but I don't think that's what it is. Every player who played for him spoke incredibly highly of him and his ability to motivate and set a tone. And in the end, I think that's the main thing that a manager does. He's not as well remembered as some managers who were less successful, and at least according to this one category, everyone was less successful, and I think that's because he was not a particularly quotable guy. I suspect he had a lot of anxiety. He was known as a heavy drinker, a very heavy drinker, and he would occasionally miss games due to having gone on some kind of binge. He loved White Horse Scotch, would keep some in his desk wherever he went, and he might occasionally fail to emerge from a hotel room or a berth on a train for a day or so. But the thing about that is that he was born in 1887 and he lived until 1978. He was past 90 when he died. And it seems incongruous to me that he would live that long and be that self-abusive. And I wonder if once he had given up the stress of the job, then he could put down the bottle, relax, and enjoy life a little bit. So perhaps because of that anxiety, or perhaps because he just was a kind of control freak in general, he went out of his way not to be very quotable. He was famous for saying, "Let me worry about that." So if a beat writer talking to him before a game said, "Hey Joe, how's Gehrig's lumbago?" he'd say, "Let me worry about that." "Hey Joe, who's going to pitch the series opener in Chicago tomorrow?" "Let me worry about that." "Hey Joe, Pat Malone seemed a little worse for wear coming to the ballpark today. Seems like he had a late night." "Let me worry about that." He frustrated the hell out of guys on deadline. And the only reason he was able to get away with that is that first-person quotes were much less a part of sports reporting then than they might be now. Given his reticence, it is ironic that one of the anecdotes most often told about Joe, stop me if you've heard this one, you may, but I want to tell it anyway, is kind of a joke. He said he had had a dream. He dreamed that he had died and gone to heaven, and God Almighty had asked him to put together a ball club. And he was contemplating the possible roster, all the greats of the game who had gone on to their reward, when the phone rang. It was Satan. And Satan asked him to get up a game. "Are you nuts?" Joe said. "I've got all the players. I've got Ruth. I've got Gehrig. I've got Pete Browning. I've got Matt Kemp." And Satan said, "I know, but I've got all the umpires." You know why that story occurred to me today? Because on Wednesday night, down in Alabama, a certain politician filed a lawsuit trying to prevent the certification of the Senate election he had just lost, alleging massive fraud. And it seems to me that such a lawsuit would not have any hope of succeeding, given that the margin of loss was about 22,000 votes. You could prove 21,999 cases of voter fraud and still lose by one, and no one proves 21,999 cases of voter fraud, especially in an era in which ID is required to vote in so many states, including that one. You're talking about the average daily attendance of the 2017 Cincinnati Reds being brought into the state and somehow getting access to a ballot with fake IDs. I can believe 10, I can believe 100, I can even believe 1,000, but 22,000. A silent, perfectly disciplined conspiracy of 22,000. That defies belief. And said candidate must know that. So why would you file such a suit unless you believed that you had friends in high places, that the fix was in, and that, like Satan, you had all the umpires.
I dreamed last night I got on the boat to heaven, and by some chance I had brought my dice along, and there I stood, and I hollered, "Someone fade me!" But the passengers, they knew right from wrong, for the people all said, "Sit down, sit down, you're rocking a boat." The people all said, sit down, you're rocking a boat. And the devil will drag you under by the sharp lapel of your checkered coat. Sit down, sit down, sit down, sit down, sit down, you're rocking a boat.
There's another story about McCarthy that's supposed to be funny, but it's not really, and I very much doubt it's true because it has a vaudeville kind of sound to it. But he had the rowdy, hard-drinking West Virginian Hack Wilson from 1926 to 1930, when both were with the Cubs. And Wilson was about as good as anybody ever was at that time, just for those few years, and then not so much, and part of that was due to his drinking. By that time, McCarthy had been run out of Chicago by Rogers Hornsby, who wasn't so well disposed towards Hack, and you can link Hack's decline to that change of bosses, as well, of course, as the degenerative effects of staying out all night, running around, and being continually intoxicated or hungover. But be that as it may, there's a story that McCarthy tried to caution Wilson on the evils of drink. This is a bit ironic given what I told you about White Horse Scotch, but okay. And the story says, it comes in shorter and longer forms, and I'll give you the shorter one, that McCarthy took Wilson aside and put a glass of whiskey in front of him and dropped a live worm into it. The worm promptly died, and McCarthy said, "Now, Hack, what does that prove to you about drinking?" And Wilson replied, "It proves that if you drink, you'll never get worms." As I said, not really funny, and kind of a relic of an age when alcoholism was not a disease, but some kind of choice that people made out of weakness, and of course, it killed Hack at a very young age. In fact, we'll be observing the anniversary, the 70th, of his premature death in 2018. You know, I said premature just then. That was wrong. Most of us don't get to choose the time and place, and maybe Hack didn't name the exact date, but he chose. The bottle was his infinite inning, so think real hard before you pick one up. They can be heavier than they look. That's a heavy thought for a new year, so before we kick off the theme song, let me give you one other McCarthy story, which is perhaps not gust-a-butt funny, but has the benefit of being true. In 1940, the Yankees were working on their fifth straight pennant. They didn't win it, in part because McCarthy bollocksed up some personnel changes. He convinced himself that one of his top prospects, Rizzuto, who was tearing it up in the minors, wasn't ready, and he defaulted back to Frank Crisetti as shortstop for another year. Crisetti turned out to be done at 29, hit 194 with a 299 on base, and McCarthy was slow to cotton to this and left him in the leadoff spot for more than the first half of the season. Kind of like leading off Alcides Escobar for a year. Eventually he put Joe Gordon up there. That wasn't the only reason they didn't win. Lefty Gomez, one of their top pitchers, got hurt, and Babe Dahlgren proved to be an inadequate replacement for Lou Gehrig, and he and McCarthy didn't get along. McCarthy spread some really negative rumors about Dahlgren smoking marijuana, which at the time was kind of a bigger stain on his reputation than it might be now. But another reason that they didn't win was kind of stranger than that. Keep in mind, the race was very close that year. The Tigers won the American League, but only by one game over the Indians and two games over the Yankees. So if you point to any one reason as the reason they lost, you'll be right. Could be Crisetti or Dahlgren or the sudden decline of Lou Gehrig the year before, or it could simply be this. The A's had a pitcher that year, a journeyman named Johnny Babich out of the Pacific Coast League. And you know how Catfish Hunter used to say that the sun don't shine on the same dog's ass every day? Well, this was the year that the sun was shining on Johnny Babich's ass, or at least his baseball cap. And he had a really good year for the A's. Not a Max Scherzer year or anything, but just a strong, solid year. Overall, he went 14-13, and his 3.73 ERA was about half a run below league average. But here's how that broke down. He went 9-12 with a 4.22 ERA against all the teams that weren't the Yankees. Against the Yankees, he went 5-1 with a 2.08 ERA. In September, as the Yankees were trying to make up ground, he pitched a 5-hit shutout against them, and McCarthy, in his exasperation, was overheard shouting, "Babich! Babich! Who the hell is Babich?" Well, he should have been paying closer attention. He was an ex-Yankee. In 1939, just the year before, the then 26-year-old was pitching for the Yankees farm team, the Kansas City Blues of the American Association, and he had gone 17-6 with a 2.55 ERA. Connie Max A's had picked him up in the Rule 5 draft that October. You'd think Joe would have known that. Who the hell is Babich? He's the guy you and your scouts missed. I'm Stephen Goldman, and this is the Infinite Inning Baseball Podcast. From the grocery store, Belinda is agitated. Baby New Year is a monster.
No, honey, that's what you said about the last one. You know how you can get.
I admit I was wrong about Laura. She's a wonderful child, but Baby New Year is something different. This morning when I went to the crib, he was fondling your straight razor.
My God! Did you take it away from him?
I tried! Look! She held up a bandaged finger. Your heart sinks.
We'll just have to take this one back and try again. We must keep trying.
You know we can't. We just have to accept him as he is and carry on.
Maybe there's another way. Maybe if we just ignore him, he'll go away.
Come with me. We'll shut the door and listen to episode 35 until it's all over. Can you really do that for a full year? Just stay in bed one of these days? Possibly. We should try. Welcome back to the show, our last of 2017, and whether you're listening to this before the evening of the 31st or after, may I wish you a heartfelt Happy New Year. May this one be sweet and better than the year before. We've set an extraordinarily low bar. As you know, I improvise those little post-music segments where I tell you some little horror story in which it would have been better to listen to this show than do whatever the thing is that's being described. And I realized as I was coming up with that one that it might owe a tiny little something to a classic Ray Bradbury story that I hope you'll seek out. It's truly disturbing. It's called The Small Assassin, and he wrote it way back in 1946. You can find it in some of his more horror-oriented collections, like The October Country. On one hand, it's just a scary little story that might anticipate something like Rosemary's Baby. On another, it may be kind of a take on postpartum depression and the way that that can really mess you up in terms of your perception of your child. Give it a read. Let me know what you think. Also, true confession time, you may be wondering if, when in the introduction, I said butt-gusting instead of gut-busting, I was just being cute or that was a naturally occurring spoonerism. And the truth is, it was that. It just happened by accident and I wasn't really aware of it till I heard the playback. And so let that be a lesson to me. Never listen to the playback. As with the Thanksgiving week show, this week's installment of the Infinite Inning will be somewhat less infinite than usual, if that's possible. We have eschewed a guest for this one time out. We will resume that practice next week. It's just that with the various holidays going on, I figure you've all gotten to where you're going, and I hope you're all on vacation somewhere and that you all have less time to listen than usual because you're busy having fun. Just enough time for a couple of quick conversations with me, and then it's back to the hot tub or the ski slope or the stalled Matterhorn bobsled ride at Disneyland.
your mileage may vary. Speaking of mileage varying, you'll get great mileage out of listening to Ben Lindbergh's Effectively Wild podcast over at Fangraphs with his normal co-host Jeff Sullivan on vacation. He tabbed me to jump in and do a reader mailbag episode. Somehow I managed to get through that whole experience without dropping a Perry Como We Get Letters reference. And I think as offbeat team-up issues go, this was a pretty good one. So please head on over when you're done here. As we discussed on that show, it's really strange how strictured this off-season has been. It really feels like something is wrong right now. And yeah, it's the holidays, it's after the winter meetings, and baseball executives are on a break just like you're on a break. They're skiing and going to Disneyland too, and that's understandable. But it's odd how outside of the deconstruction of the Marlins, how relatively little has gone on. And some of that, I think, is due to the nature of the free agent market, which is largely populated by players who are not exactly stars, or are occasionally stars but come with a significant amount of risk, but of course they're going to want to be paid like stars. Do you pay J.D. Martinez like the guy who slugged 740 for the Diamondbacks, knowing that nobody really keeps up that level of production, that he's 30 and not a good glove? Do you sign Lorenzo Cain knowing that he tends to get hurt and that he's going on 32 and is not incredibly consistent offensively? You give either of those guys 3 to 5 years and you might be in trouble on the back end, if not right away. Mike Moustakas has power, but he's 29 years old, has a career 310 on base percentage against right-handed pitching, and isn't so good a glove. In fact, isn't Pi Trainer with the glove. So he should probably be platooned against left-handed pitching, against whom he's a career 241, 291, 396 hitter. But again, he's not going to want to get paid like a 400 at-bat a year player, and he's not going to want to sign with the team that makes him into a 400 at-bat a year player. If I'm the Astros, I'd be kind of salivating to sign Jake Arrieta, or the idea of Jake Arrieta, to bolster the back of that rotation even further. But do you? Which Arrieta do you get? You certainly don't get that peak year Cy Young Arrieta of a few years ago. Or maybe you sign Yu Darvish. But do Darvish's injuries and the way he looked in October bug you? Yeah, they definitely do. So you don't want to make that commitment, and it's completely understandable. At the same time, we should see some trades as a result of the fact that the free agent market is not exactly Costco this year in terms of variety, but we haven't seen that either. It increasingly seems like there are a handful of teams in win-now mode and a whole bunch more teams that just ain't bothering. And there's nothing wrong with that exactly if you're going to build through the farm like the Phillies have done, although I kind of question that Carlos Santana signing. But it's a slow process, and as valuable as some of these prospects are, they're not all perfectly distributed, which is to say, have the courage of your convictions, teams that are building through the farm. If, say, the Phillies have a player that doesn't quite fit in their system but might look good on the Giants and vice versa, make the deal. Let's put the guys where the opportunities are. Let's accelerate this thing. It entails considerable risk. If one of your own prospects doesn't develop, well, people will say that happens sometimes. If you trade a prospect for a prospect and the guy you acquire busts and the other guy turns into Mickey Mantle, your name will be mud for all eternity, we get that. But still, if you're going to base everything on the perspicacity of your scouting and drafting acumen, let's go! As we head into the new year, truly, this is the winter of our discontent, or at least our inertia. And that's a shame, because we need to make things happen. Passivity has gotten us where we are, and it's gotten some of these teams where they are. Like Dickens' Mr. Micawber, they just sit around saying, something will turn up. But it doesn't turn up, and the opposite is just kind of a slide into chaos and entropy. In his Devil's Dictionary, Ambrose Bierce defined the future as that period of time in which our affairs prosper, our friends are true, and our happiness is assured. In other words, Ambrose Bierce thinks we're idiots, and I use the present tense because, as he was never found dead, there's still a very small chance that he's still alive. This glorious end of the rainbow future will only be ours if we make an effort to achieve it, but mostly we don't. We just accept that things are fine, they're going along fine. That's a terrible word, fine. It closes off all possibility and encourages complacency. And after the break, I'll talk a bit about a team that said that things were fine, they're fine. The World Series winning 1983 Baltimore Orioles. I'll be right back after this word from our sponsor.
And we're back. As we turn to the Orioles, one other word about being proactive heading into the new year. This applies to baseball teams and everything else, that sometimes when things are going all right and you look at your situation and you say, again, here's that dangerous word, everything's fine. It's fine. There are steps you might take prophylactically to improve your situation, even though it doesn't necessarily need that urgently. You can just see a couple of steps down the road that there might be a problem. It might just be that your designated hitter is on the verge of aging out, or it might be something more significant than that. And I keep thinking of this in terms of the New Deal of the 1930s, the package of reforms the government enacted to make economic distribution more fair. The New Deal wasn't about generosity or social justice. I mean, it might have been for some people. It certainly was for some people, maybe Eleanor Roosevelt or Harry Hopkins or someone. But for more middle-of-the-road thinkers, and I think that included the president, Franklin Roosevelt, they were seriously concerned that people were so angry, so destitute, and occasionally so hungry that there might be a revolution here, just like in Russia, which, as FDR took office in 1932, was only 15 years earlier. It was easily within living memory. And here's the reason that in the United States today, the poor, at least cosmetically, look relatively comfortable, and they allow for people to demagogue their status, people who are supposedly buying lobster with food stamps and so on. And the reason for that is the reason that you don't see all but the most extremely poor or damaged in some other way foraging for food on the streets. In fact, you may see them at home and they may be able to afford a television set. Is that we enacted just enough of a safety net that all but the very worst off of us get to sleep in something approximating a home. So they're invisible to us, and they're invisible to each other, and thus there's no movement around them, either from well-meaning, concerned people, or from the underprivileged themselves. And that works in both directions, because as time went by and they got further into the 30s, people who thought about these things became less concerned about a Russian revolution, a revolution from the left, and instead, looking at events in Germany, Italy, Japan, and other places, they started to get a little twitchy about a revolution from the right. Here's Franklin Roosevelt in 1938 explaining why the greatest weapon against fascism is a bit of a social safety net.
In recommending this program, I am thinking not only of the immediate economic needs of the people of the nation, but also of their personal liberties, the most precious possession of all Americans. I am thinking of our democracy. I am thinking of the recent trend in other parts of the world away from the democratic ideal. Democracy has disappeared in several other great nations. Disappeared not because the people of those nations disliked democracy, but because they had grown tired of unemployment and insecurity, of seeing their children hungry, while they sat helpless in the face of government confusion, government weakness, weakness through lack of leadership in government. Finally, in desperation, they chose to sacrifice liberty in the hope of getting something to eat. We in America know that our own democratic institutions can be preserved and made to work. But in order to preserve them, we need to act together, to meet the problems of the nation boldly, and to prove that the practical operation of democratic government is equal to the task of protecting the security of the people. Not only our future economic soundness, but the very soundness of our democratic institutions depends on the determination of our government to give employment to idle men. The people of America are in agreement in defending their liberties at any cost, and the first line of that defense lies in the protection of economic security. Your government, seeking to protect democracy, must prove that government is stronger than the forces of business depression. History proves that dictatorships do not grow out of strong and successful governments, but out of weak and helpless governments.
From there to the case of the 1983 Orioles, sometimes a team winning a World Series isn't the beginning of something. It's not the foundation of a dynasty, but the end of one. The Orioles had been pretty good fairly consistently from their 1966 World Championship onward. One key factor was that after about 1967, when they drafted Bobby Critch, a Hall of Fame-level player who just happens not to be in the Hall of Fame, they blew pretty much every first-round draft pick for the next, 15, 20 years. From the beginning of the draft until the end of the 1980s, the Orioles had just a handful of players who achieved even 10 WAR in the major leagues. They drafted Gritch, who had 70.9, this is Baseball Reference version. In 1974, second baseman Rich Dower had 14. And then you have to skip all the way down to 1987 and Pete Harnisch, who had 18.2. 1988, Greg Olson, who had 13.2. 1989, things are getting better. Ben McDonald, 20.9. And finally, another Hall of Fame type, 1990, Mike Messina, 83. If you hear paper crinkling in the background, by the way, that's not me and my notes. I do have notes for this. I haven't memorized the Orioles draft. That's my 20-pound cat, Mickey. He's invaded my studio space here, and I'm going to persevere rather than throw him out because, frankly, when you have a 20-pound cat, and he's not fat, he's just big-boned, when you have a 20-pound cat and he decides that he's going to be in your office no matter what you do. And the alternative is I lock the door. I just close the door. But doors cannot hold him. And I can lock the door, and then what you will hear in the background, rather than papers crinkling, and this may be preferable, is thunk, 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 as he tries to work his way in. So anything in the background, I apologize for. I'm trying to persevere and get this out before the holiday, and I am beset by wild animals who are 20 pounds. As a result of their failures in the draft and the fact that they weren't huge players to this point, at least in free agency, the Orioles had a strange team. They had Eddie Murray, who was an MVP-level player every year, and they had Cal Ripken, who was 22 and in God mode. And they had a great pitching staff, but the thing about the pitching staff was that it didn't have any number one Cy Young types. It had some guys who had won them. Mike Flanagan had won one in the late 70s. Jim Palmer had won about a million of them in that same decade, but he was about done then. Back problems were about to end his career. And so they had more guys like Scott McGregor, who was dominant that year, had a 3.18 ERA and never struck anybody out, but he also never walked anybody. He was that kind of pinpoint control lefty. And as they went into the postseason, that's really what played up. They allowed about 3 runs in 37 innings against the White Sox in the ALCS. Then in the World Series against the Philadelphia Phillies, they had an ERA of 1.60. And then you had no third baseman to think of. It's weird to think of a team winning a World Series with such a huge hole, but Orioles third baseman in 1983 hit .210 with a .262 on base and a .300 slugging percentage. They acquired a guy named Todd Cruz partway through the season, and he wasn't any good either, but he was better than nothing. And so it turned out that a marginal upgrade was almost the same relative to where they started as acquiring Mike Schmidt. That's how far the gap was between them and adequacy. Third base aside, they were very good at other positions, but they had a whole bunch of platoons. And John Lowenstein, the platoon left fielder, was 36, and Al Bumbrey, the platoon center fielder, was 36, and the DH, Ken Singleton, was 36, and all these guys either still were or had been really good players, especially Singleton. Singleton was an extraordinary hitter, and Bumbrey had some great years in center field, and the Lowenstein platoon with Gary Renicky was kind of famous as platoons go. If you're a collector of platoons, it's up there. But you don't know when that's all going to stop, especially when players are that age. And what happened the next season in 1984 is that everybody kind of aged out at once. And here's the key thing about that, is that they weren't prepared for it at all. Again, there weren't replacements in the minor leagues. What they had, they did have a couple of good prospects, and one of them, at least briefly, Mike Young, the right fielder, worked out. He didn't turn out to have an enduring career, which was part of their problem in this period. that offseason after the World Series, they didn't really look at any of this and address it aggressively, whether through trades or the free agent market. They did sign Wayne Gross to be their third baseman, and he's not well remembered, but he was a hell of a player for them. He was a lefty platoon three true outcomes guy. And in two seasons with the Orioles, he had about one full season of plate appearances. He had 678 plate appearances, 559 at bats, and he only hit 224, but with a 355 on base and a 435 slugging, because in those plate appearances, he hit 33 home runs and he walked 114 times. And I don't think anybody really thought he was very good, because back then batting average was a bigger deal. And again, he only hit 235, but today he'd be Todd Frazier. The guys that they stood pat with, like Singleton, killed them the next year. Ken Singleton, as a hitter in a career of 15 years, was basically lower scale Joey Votto. He was a guy who walked 100 times a year and hit up to 35 home runs. And his batting averages generally weren't quite as high, but you have to discount for the fact that it was the 1970s. So his 282 is actually very good looking. But in 1984, he was 37 and he just hit the wall and was done. He hit 215. His power disappeared. The patience disappeared. Just nothing worked. And that was the end of his career. And on a war basis, he was basically the Albert Pujols 2017 of 1984. And the Orioles slid down to what was actually a really good record, 85-77, but it was a competitive division, a highly competitive division, and they only finished fifth. And they were headed downwards from there, because here was their reaction. They started signing free agents like crazy, and if you read the history of this period, it's not clear whose idea this was. There was a dispute between the owner, Edward Bennett Williams, who was dying of cancer and was perhaps a bit twitchy to win, which never works, really. It's the Gene Autry method, right? And Hank Peters, the general manager, and they just started bringing in any free agent they could without discrimination. So they cut some of these oldsters, and for the 1985 season, they just went on a shopping spree, and it was as if they were in veteran player withdrawal, because essentially what they did was replaced old players with old players. Fred Lynn, who was 33 and had more injuries than Queen has greatest hits packages, and Lee Lacy, who was 37, and also Don Asse, a reliever, a closer, who was only 30 but also had an injury history, and turned out to be spectacularly ill-suited to pitch in the AL East for this simple reason. He could not get Don Mattingly out. If you look at his career line versus Don Mattingly, Mattingly, in their first eight meetings, went 7-for-8 with a double and two home runs. And after that, they didn't let him pitch to Don Mattingly. They found a way to avoid it because it just wasn't worth it. Adding players of this vintage is not a bad idea in isolation, by which I mean maybe one, and as the cherry on top of your pennant-winning sundae. To start reinforcing your lineup with them willy-nilly, pell-mell, is to accelerate the aging process in a rather rapid way. And that's what happened to the Orioles. And I won't give you the blow-by-blow of the next 4 years, but by 1988, they literally couldn't win a game to start the season and went 54-107, which is one of the more pathetic records that doesn't belong to the Tigers in the post-war period. As a result of that free agent signing binge for 1985, by the way, the Orioles tanked their entire draft. They had no first, second, or third round pick that year. And that by itself is enough punishment to set an organization back quite a ways. So I don't have a huge takeaway here. Normally I like to give you a lot of quotes and first person stuff about what happened. But in this case, it's a purely academic study. When I was a kid, there was this interstitial feature, it was really a commercial, I guess, that ran on the Saturday game of the week on NBC with Vin Scully. It was the great umpire Doug Harvey with "You Make the Call." They would present a problem in umpiring, and there would be a plug for State Farm, I think, and then they would tell you what Doug's call would be. And he would say, "Look it up. Please." There was a certain desperation or urgency with that "please." This is that kind of thing. It's not exactly a drama. It's not exactly a story with a huge emotional takeaway. It's just a problem that, if they taught general managing in college, and for all I know, maybe they do now, this would be something to study. A choose-your-own-adventure book. How do you save the mid-80s Orioles from their inevitable collapse? And the answer, I'm afraid, may be the same one that too many teams are pursuing this winter, and have baseball in a deeper freeze than even the weather that's presently gripping the country does. You have to tear it down and rebuild. Eddie Murray was only 27 in 1983. As I said before, Cal Ripken was 22. Everything else must go. You can't trade Cal Ripken and improve. You just can't. I don't care what prospects you get. And the same is really true for a mid-20s Eddie Murray. But they didn't have it on the farm, and they weren't going to get it through free agency, especially in the era of collusion. They were only going to get fringy guys like Lynn, who, by the way, when I say fringy, like, you could make a case. It's a thin case, but you can make a case that Lynn sort of scrapes the Hall of Fame, or with one or two more decent seasons, he would have been a Hall of Famer. It's just that he was old and fragile. And the question we're now facing is there a way to incentivize enough teams to not pursue that route that we actually have some pennant races this year, which we largely didn't have in 2017? And again, the problem is the alternative is what the Orioles did, and that way lies disaster too. And let me bring this full circle, because the teams that do decide to rebuild are smart. Teams that go into denial about that are the ones that are in trouble. I've often written that if you do not decide to rebuild, then God will decide to rebuild for you. And again, as with so much in baseball, that applies to so many aspects of our life, and it applies to what I was telling you about the Great Depression too, and government policy even today, which is to say, back then they thought, well, let's give people a few bucks so that, on one hand, they're not susceptible to finding millionaires and scapegoating them and hanging them from lampposts, and on the other hand, they're not susceptible to demagogic appeals, which scapegoat minorities, and we don't end up hanging them from lampposts. Which, by the way, even here in America, they were doing in great numbers. In Germany, it was Jews. Here in America, at that time, it was African Americans. Such is the tragedy. We've never completely dealt with that. This is why Frederick Douglass's advice to the young, agitate, 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 are so valuable, because the universe is a constant war against the forces of entropy, and we can't defeat it, but if you don't agitate, if you don't battle it, that's complacency, and entropy automatically wins. Entropy is the enemy of baseball teams, it's the enemy of good governance, it's the enemy of any happiness in our lives. But there are always those who are agents of entropy, and will try to sow it for their own purposes. Sometimes they're owners who say, I have to win now, so start bringing in the 38-year-olds because we don't have time to wait for a 22-year-old to figure out how to play Major League Baseball. That's ridiculous and contrary. A 22-year-old is about to peak. A 38-year-old is about to unlearn how to play Major League Baseball. And sometimes it's a politician who says, let's make more rich people and more poor people at the same time. And in both cases, you end up with the 1988 Orioles, except that in the former case, the baseball case, it's just an inconsequential losing season and a disgruntled fan base. In the other, it's something much bigger, much more pernicious, and very dangerous. And since we are heading into the anniversary season of those 1988 Orioles, the team that began their season 0-21, surely the worst, but just one of what was a dozen consecutive seasons in which the Orioles did not make the postseason, this is something to keep in mind. There, but for the grace of God and our own willingness to intervene in our lives, go we the way of the 88 Orioles. And before I leave you to celebrate that new year, one happier note. I just said happier note, and thus I'm not going to comment on the Rockies signing Wade Davis, because that'll just get me started talking about Ian Desmond again, and you really don't want me to go there. But a happier story, and this one goes back to the 83 Orioles. This was the game of their season, and a fairly unique one that was kind of famous in its day. On August 24th, 1983, they were playing the Toronto Blue Jays at home in Baltimore, and they went to the 10th, tied 3-3. The Orioles went to Tim Stoddard, their setup reliever. He got whacked by Cliff Johnson, a guy I've talked about in previous episodes of this show. He gave up a home run, and then he gave up a single to the next batter, Barry Bonnell. And at that point, the Orioles manager, Joe Altobelli, because even Earl Weaver had gotten out of Dodge at this point, although he wasn't immune to being brought back. But in any case, he had retired. He was over it. He was still over it when he came back. But the Orioles yanked Stoddard, and they brought in their closer, Tippi Martinez, even though they were down now by one run. The first thing that happens is, with Bonnell on first, Martinez throws over, and he picks him off. One out.
He then walks Dave Collins, the pinch hitter. He picks him off. Two outs. Willie Upshaw hits an infield single, at which point Martinez picked him off. Three outs. Orioles down, going to the bottom of the ninth, whereas it should have been much, much worse. Leading off the bottom of the 10th, Cal Ripken homers. A couple of batters later, Len Sakata, the utility infielder, hits a three-run walk-off shot, and the Orioles win the game 7-4. Basically because their closer, a lefty by the way, picked off three consecutive base runners. I'd say you'll never see that again, but you play enough baseball games, you'll see everything again. It'd be kind of wonderful, wouldn't it? I feel like, though, if Andy Pettit didn't somehow do it, then it's not going to happen. And on that note, I would once again like to wish you a very happy new year. I thank you for spending so much time with me in this, the first year of the Infinite Inning, and I look forward to much more time with you to come in the new year and many more episodes of baseball conversation and storytelling and so on. So please, be safe, but tip one back for me when you're celebrating. I mean, not like Hack Wilson, okay? He lived to regret it. He even said so in the last interview before he died. He said, don't be like me. Just like Mickey Mantle did. It's eerie how that repeated itself. So, not like that. Let those among us who have driven in 191 runs in a season, maybe they can hit Hack Wilson levels of consumption. But for the rest of us, let's keep it maybe not abstemious, but careful. Camptown Ladies, sing this song. We have reached the end of another episode. Given that this is a somewhat brief show, at least by my standards, we're at the 42-minute mark, I'm going to keep the credits equally brief and say only that you can follow me on Twitter at GoStephenGoldman. Why GoStephenGoldman? Because for God's sake, everyone else has fled to someplace warm and I'm still here. Stephen Goldman, you need to stop podcasting and go, at least for this week. But not permanently, I hope. Assuming the St. Bernards don't knock off early and leave me to freeze drinking all of the booze they carry themselves. A lot of booze talk this episode, and I can't even drink. I'll be back next week with more tales and discussion from inside the Infinite Inning. Happy New Year.